Matt Stadlin on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
As I'm sure you know by now, I'm a passionate photographer and a passionate wildlife photographer, so who better to have caught up with just before I came on air than David Yarrow, who I believe is the best-selling wildlife photographer in the world. He's not just a wildlife photographer. Go and find him on Instagram. Go and Google him. He is quite the artist. And he joined me, as I say, just a few moments before coming on air. And I started by asking him, well, given that he is one of the most glamorous jobs. He has one of the most glamorous jobs in the world, to my mind anyway, and you can tell me whether you disagree. I wondered how he took these incredible shots of wildlife and supermodels, and he gets to go to quite extraordinary parts of the world. And I said, listen, how did you get to do all this?
Well, I have taken my time. In 1986, I was on the pitch of the World Cup final. To the picture of Diego Maradona 32 years ago, 33 years ago. So I could be accused of just taking a bit more time than other people might have done. I think success is 99% failure, and I have failed a lot in certain things, but I was never going to quit. And I think photography, don't know about you, but I can't really identify many good things about getting older.
I certainly can't.
But one good thing is you should become maybe more emotionally intelligent. And if you become more emotionally intelligent, that should feed through into your photography, because photography isn't really about a camera. It's about cameras, just a conduit. It's just conveying what you feel and what you think. I think as you get older, you should get better. I've worked hard. I saw an opportunity. I saw a gap in the market. And when I was fairly miserable in finance, every evening I'd come home and try and work on a business plan that would allow me to pursue my passion. I think if you go and pursue a passion and you don't make money from it, that's fine. That's wonderfully romantic and you know, great. But if you do need to make money from it, and most people do need to make money from what they're doing, you should have a commercial plan, a business plan. I think a lot of photographers don't. They just go and say, I'm going to take pictures. And that's tricky now because everyone's a photographer in 2019, and that is why businesses like Getty Images struggle, because there's an awful lot of stock photography around. And I knew that wasn't going to be the future. I knew the future would be in the fine art market if you could get it right.
There are so many photographers, as you say, these days. In one sense, we're all photographers. And Instagram is populated, particularly by, in terms of what you do, by wildlife photography. Do you feel in any way competitive to the upstarts? How do you manage to stay ahead? What do you think it is that sets you apart, all modesty aside?
Well, I think modesty, in a sense of your own fallibility, is integral to it. You can never be complacent, so you just want to get better. I think photography is quite collegiate. When I see a great picture that someone else has taken, I don't turn around and go, oh my God, this some guy is taking really good, or girl is taking really good pictures. You celebrate it. It's not like, I think in a way, like the professional golf market, I think the golfers are all celebrate each other's successes. So if you see a new person coming through, I think you celebrate it because it's good for the fraternity in a way. And if he or she is taking pictures that help raise awareness, that's all good. You just got to look after yourself. I think that I have a paranoia of the mundane, and maybe that's an insecurity. I think a lot of artists are insecure. I think, which is maybe quite a good thing, because you're always questioning whether the marketplace needs to see this shot. I think a mistake a lot of photographers do make is they address your aforementioned plurality of content with their own plurality. And what you should be doing is addressing the plurality with a very tough edit. Hans Ladam said, you know, if you can take 10 good pictures a year, that's an amazing year. And I work with the guys at Victoria's Secret, and I actually reckon if you can take 4 good pictures a year, I think that's a good year, four or five.
How much of your work, David, takes place out there in the field, and how much in the edit? If you take a photograph, for example, this wonderful shot of a lioness moving through the grasses, how much of that was in the taking of the photograph and obviously in the preparation that went before that, and how much in the edit?
Well, I can't. I'm not sure the picture that you're talking about now, but I think I know the one with the dust kicking up and it's backlit.
Yes.
I make pictures. I don't necessarily take them. I think there's two sorts of photographers. There's people that make pictures and there's people that take them. I don't say one's better than the other, but I'm very much a maker because I have a preconception of what I'm trying to get for, and then I try and linearly follow it through. The idea of that shot actually came from Ridley Scott's film Gladiator, in the first few seconds of the film when Russell Crowe's hands going through the reeds and it's backlit. So I get
ideas. One of the most famous shots in cinema.
Yeah, and because it lulled everyone into a sort of false sense of security before the whole enormity of the battle ahead of you. You know, it is that wonderful scene in False Guitars where John Cleese says to the woman that's not happy with her room, he says, "Ma'am, that's Torquay. What did you expect? A Krakatoa erupting in the background, or herds of roaming wildebeest sweeping majestically across the plain?" We don't put a Krakatoa erupting in the background, or we don't add things. We might, if there's a lump of elephant shit, we might remove the elephant manure in front of the elephant, because why would anyone want to look at that? And I have no problem with that, because I don't work for National Geographic. I'm an artist, so I would try and make a picture. I would take anything out that maybe doesn't make the picture that nice. But I won't put anything in.
Tell me the risks that you seem to take. If I look at this photograph, I'm looking up at the lioness, and it looks to me as though it's within meters of my lens. So how do you stay alive, David?
Well, I've got two kids and I'm responsible. So if there's risks, I probably embellish to tell people it's more dangerous than it is. I think with animals and animal behavior very well, I think. So I work with lions, I work in cages quite a bit. With elephants, I use remotes. With polar bears, I make sure there's they don't tend to jump on a small boat, so I quite often work from very small boats. You know, the biggest risks I've had have always been with people, because people, by and large, can do three things that animals can't do. They can get high, they can get drunk, and they can buy an AK-47. And those things, that combination can be occasionally a little bit tricky. So my more nervous moments have always been with people. I was in North Korea a bit last year, and actually got on very well. I thought they were absolutely charming to me. But when your heart beats a little bit, it tends to be with humans rather than with animals. I've had the odd moment with an animal, but I tend to go. I know where I'm going, and I think I know what I'm doing.
Thought for a second you were going to say you get on terribly well with Kim Jong Un, but that would be a bit of a stretch. I want to also go on.
No, I was very keen to take his portrait, and I had a lot of conversations with the North Koreans, and it's still not it's not been removed as a possibility. It's just, as you can imagine, there's a lot of red tape. I just thought someone should demystify him, but whether I'd be able to demystify him in a way that I'd like, goodness only knows. But it's worth it. Nothing venture, nothing gain.
You spend a lot of your time in the natural world. I think right now you're in Glencoe and you're going to be doing a shoot up there. Beautiful, beautiful part of the world, the Glencoe Pass, one of the most extraordinary sights on these isles. But it strikes me that you're not just a taker. You don't just take photographs. As you say, you make photographs, but you're not just taking out of a landscape. You also care about conservation. You give. And in a way, the act of taking a photograph or the act of sharing that image is giving, because it's promoting the wild world to the rest of us. But talk in a little bit more in detail, in your own words, about your work in conservation and why you feel passionate about it.
Well, I think first and foremost, as soon as you have children, and if those children aren't lucky enough to be able to go to a place where there really are wild animals, and of course they can do that in Scotland. There's some quite big wild beasts up here, but in terms of the more exotic ones, we live with a ticking time clock, and of course everyone is increasingly aware of this. I think there's been a bit of a sort of zeitgeist recently that it's gone from being at the periphery of our conscience to maybe not as clear and not as close to the forefront of our conscience as something like Brexit, but it's become something that people are aware of, that we are just tenants on the planet, and whether it be orangutans under pressure because people are burning down the rainforests, or whether it be elephants under pressure for poaching of ivory, or rhinos for the horn.
Or polar bears, as you've already mentioned.
Yeah, and polar bears. I mean, I can sometimes say things that other people don't agree with. I'm sure you do that from time to time.
Yeah.
Polar bears, I'm less concerned about, because the biggest issue, poaching gets all the headlines, but the big issue really is just population growth. And population growth is a faster accelerator than global warming. I know the two are related, but habitat loss is going to be greater in parts of Africa than it's going to be in Baffin Island. So the acceleration of habitat loss in Africa, I'm not a disbeliever in global warming. I just think that not many people are going to start inhabiting these places in Siberia where the temperature is minus 40. And I know they're getting warmer, but they're still bloody cold a lot of the time. I've been up there. So it's not going to be a place where the polar bears are losing their habitat as quickly. They are losing it, but not quite as quickly as the lion. So I don't want people to turn around and say he doesn't know what he's talking about because polar bears' habitat is being destroyed. I get it. It's just that the lion's habitat's getting is disappearing quicker.
What can we all do, David, to contribute to the conservation efforts around the world to save our species?
Well, I think there's two or three things. I mean, if everyone said, I can't change it, then we're going to get anywhere, and one person can't change it. There's some Americans that are making a big difference. I mean, there's two things. There's at a level where everyone can be involved. It's just growing awareness. It is awareness that leads to change. The big movements we've seen over the last 2 years, it's not been about throwing money at it. It's not like the female empowerment has come from money. It's just become this just wave of understanding that it's just been the wrong way to do things. So that's number one. The second thing, unfortunately, is really quite simple, which is money. And it's a lot of people are very critical of zoos, and you know, there's some bad zoos in the world. I'm sure if you go to the far reaches of, I don't know, I don't want to mention any country, but some parts of Eastern Europe, some of the zoos aren't going to be great. But there are some great zoos in the world, and zoos are good because if you say that there shouldn't be zoos, it's incredibly elitist because the vast majority of people can't afford to the plains of the Serengeti. So zoos can raise awareness, they can raise money for research, they can occasionally allow for breeding, and they allow for greater understanding of animal behavior. But that's not going to solve the problem. The way things ameliorate or improve is, and it's not that romantic, but romanticism is gone, is people just buy land. And through the purchase of that land, if it's protected, the animals then will live in protected land. You know, I think one problem that cancer research charities sometimes have had is, despite the huge amount of money and a huge amount of work done in the area, if you stand up in a room of wealthy people and you just tell tales of woe, then people say, well, why should good money follow bad if there's been no progress? And some conservationists, I think, are a little bit guilty of standing up in a room of a lot of wealthy people and just giving 20 shocking statistics. Well, then, we know it's bad, but what you should do is say, well, here's some statistics over the last 5 years, which shows that things are getting better. And things are getting better. And I think it's much better that you do a little bit of the good as well as all the bad. I go to parts of Africa where there hasn't been an elephant poached for 6 or 7 years. And the one common denominator is always money. and the money's coming.
Just finally, in a couple of sentences or so, top tips for listeners this morning. How do they become a great photographer?
The most important thing, I think, is to look at the pictures of others and just be visually all the time stimulated by the work of other people. I spend the whole time looking at pictures of other people. Be tough on yourself. And remember that photography is not about a camera. A camera is just a conduit. It's just a piece of metal. It's a window into your soul and your eye and your way of thinking about things. And I get terrified when I give talks that someone's going to ask me about page 268 of the manual, and I have no idea what they're talking about. And I think maybe people obsess a little bit too much on the mechanical side of things, and maybe they should focus a little bit more on their heart and soul of what they're trying to convey.
David Yarrow, thank you so much for joining us.
That's all.
That was David Yarrow speaking to me from Glencoe. What a man he is. What a life he's led. And you can find his photographs on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter. You can find it also, of course, by Googling him. Well, in what time remains to us this morning, I want to finish by asking you to dial 0345 6060973. And as we prepare for that second round of indicative votes, what would you like? How do you indicate a way forward for this country? Given that the Prime Minister's deal has failed three times, what is your solution? Just 10 minutes left. 0345 6060973. I think we could well be heading for a long delay, that despite some Cabinet Ministers urging the Prime Minister to make sure that we do leave somehow, by hook or by crook, before or by the 22nd of May. Problem is, that deadline has been forfeited because MPs voted against Theresa May's deal for a third time, as I say, on Friday. So what way out? Second referendum? Is that fair, given the likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab and David Davis have all changed their minds? They voted in the end, David Davis at the second time of asking, for the Prime Minister's deal. Should we get another opportunity? You can tweet at LBC, get in touch, 0345 6060973. Matt Standen with you, as it always is, Saturday, Sunday mornings, 1 till 5. It's 9 minutes to 5.